Good morning, everybody. I am Barbara Carmi, a member of Al-Anon. And I am grateful to be here. With this weather like it was, I was wondering. My plane was a little late leaving yesterday from Tulsa. It was real foggy, and the planes were having problems getting from where they were coming into Tulsa for me to get here. But everything's fine today. At least the streets are clear. And last night we saw some of the ice on the trees, and it's beautiful. It takes me a little while sometimes to kind of get settled down. I'm always real apprehensive when I have to speak. When I had first started speaking, and I was more nervous than I am today. I was talking this morning, and I said, I don't know why. Why am I doing here? I just don't know why people even want to hear what I have to say. And she said, she referred me to a chapter in the big book, to the family of that afterwards, where it says that our past may be our only asset, and that with this, we share with others, and it may help them to avert death. And it kind of made me know then, why I say yes when I'm really terrified of doing these things. And when I thought about death, as I think of death with the alcoholic, because they're going to die with their disease if they don't get some help or abstain from the alcohol. But there's many, many kinds of death that I realized since I've been in the program when I started learning some of these spiritual truths. There's a spiritual death, and that's where I was when I first came here. I was spiritually dead, and I was reborn. This is a very powerful organization that we belong to, a fellowship, whatever you want to call it. And with the death of the gentleman last night, Charlie and I have often talked about this. So if anything ever happened to us, we hoped it would be surrounded by the people that that are our family, and because there's a power there. Anytime you get in a gathering of AA and Al-Anon, there's a power. Even in my little group, when there's three or five of us, you feel a power. But when you get a bigger body, and then if you've ever had the opportunity to go to an international where there's thousands of people there that don't even speak the same language, but you feel it. It's just, there's no way you can even describe it when you come back home and tell somebody, because the meetings aren't always anything precious, sometimes not even as good as the ones we have at home or at our own convention. But there's a feeling that you just can't describe, because it's a power that just sort of goes through you that you share with one another. Of course, I'm feeling that this weekend. Everyone has been so nice, and of course, Sue and Cleve were just fantastic, and the room's nice, and the fruit, and I really appreciate the committee being so thoughtful. I'm here to tell you now then what happened in my life that is to be shared with you. There's a couple here that have watched me grow up in Al-Anon, and I don't know, either they're just, they must love me a lot, or they're not too smart. I don't know. But I've seen them so many years, because my mailing address is Arkansas. But we really live in Oklahoma. My children go to school in Oklahoma. We pay taxes in Oklahoma. We drive Oklahoma tags on our cars because we are within a mile of the Arkansas line. So we really are in Oklahoma and always been in Okie. I've moved around a lot. I've lived in Kansas and Missouri and different states, but I'm really in Okie. Okie born and bred. Mm-hmm. But the nearest post office is in Kansas City, Missouri. So we bank in Missouri. And so when we started in AA and Al-Anon many years ago, it seemed like, that we would go to Joplin, and we met this couple there many years ago, and we'd see them off and on, and it's just like family too. It's just such a good feeling to see a face and people that you recognize that you've been around so many years. And we've watched them, Charlie and I both have watched them change and grow in the program, and I'm sure they've watched us. But anyway, now you know where I'm from. Now, that only a drunk could live in a place like that. I'll go back to where I was when how I got to where I am today. When I was a little girl growing up, I never did know anything about alcohol. We never had alcohol in our home to speak of. I think one time the family did have a New Year's Eve party with some alcohol, but that's the only time I ever saw it or had anything, knew anything about it. There were a lot of things I didn't know much about. When I was about 13 or 14 years old, now this was back, way back in the 50s. It wasn't even the 50s when I was 15 years old, but I was in 7th and 8th grade and started looking at the boys. And and one start dating, and there was a rule in our home that you didn't date till you were 16. And my father also said there's some other rules. You know, there's certain things you don't do until you get married. And you don't get married until you graduate from high school. And he said, because if you do these things, those boys will write your name on the pool hall bathroom door. That was all meant for the bus control room. And there was mine. So, I waited until I was, May when I graduated from high school. And I got engaged the night I graduated. And got married in August. So I could do what Daddy told me I couldn't do when I got married. And that was the biggest disappointment. You know, anticipation is always greater than realization. Of course, I didn't know that. You know, you remember how it was like back when you were young, and some of you are young today, you know, and all this excitement, and you just can't wait to get to do something until, you know. So here we are, and I think this young man's father and parents probably have told him the same thing they told me. And here we are getting married, and for all the wrong reasons. There's certain requirements to really be a member of Al-Anon. Not only because your life has been affected by someone else's drinking, but you've got to be born a fixer. You know, if you're not a fixer, you just don't stay. You just don't stay around. You don't even stay in an alcoholic. If you don't live with something that needs fixing, you just don't mess with it. So I married this fella, and he just didn't know how to play house. You know, I knew how to play house. I watched my mother and father, Daddy goes off to work, he comes home, brings mother the check, Daddy stays home, plays with the kids, and we do things together on weekends. It's always a family. You know, and I just decided it didn't do that. He had all these other hobbies, he never had time for me and the children. By this time, we had two children, and we still just, you know, I just could not get him to play with the group. I could not fix him. And I was pregnant with the third child, and, you know, I could just see that this was not going to work out. I was going to end up with six or seven kids and not be able to fix this fella. And being the type of person that I am, you know, if you can't fix it, you just either get rid of it or, you know, make, so that was what I decided I better do, is just, he's not fixable, get rid of him. So we filed for divorce after I had that third child, and we were getting part of things. We knew that we just seemed like we just, this could not get along. You know, I had certain things that I wanted, and he just had his own little thing. He was just more immature. He wanted to do his thing with his sports cars and his fishing and all these other hobbies that he'd had besides me and the family. So we parted company, and I began to look for my second husband. And this time I knew what I wanted. I learned a little bit. You know, I learned the difference in being in heat and being in love. That was one thing I learned. I was still pretty naive about alcohol because I didn't know much about drinking. The only time we drank in Miss Mary's was if we had a little money on the weekend, we would go out and party maybe and do a little dancing and drinking and somebody would get drunk and puke and maybe there wouldn't be any fun. I just did not like to be around drunk. You know, I loved to go and dance, but if I got drunk, I just didn't have any use to. And for me to drink, I would always get a drink because, well, I kind of like the cherry in the bottom of the glass. And if it didn't, you know, if I let it sit long enough, it turned to linger so you didn't taste that alcohol. Because if you get very much alcohol, you start getting a little woozy, and then you can't be in control, and something may need fixing and you couldn't fix it. A real aunt, in fact, Charlie refers to me as a black belt aunt. I have to stay in control. And I would never have got this to the serum by drinking. So I really didn't have much use for somebody that would lose control of themselves and also I just really didn't have much use for drinking and alcohol. So anyway, I knew what I wanted in this next marriage. I wanted a man who would want to, would have had a good job, had enough money so that I wouldn't have to work because I had always worked. So I wanted a man that had enough money that I wouldn't have to work. I wanted a man that would want to stay home with the children and be a father to these children and give them some time like my father gave me. And I wanted a man who wanted me for a hobby. And I said, well, what I was really looking for was a rich sex maniac. Well, I left the state of Oklahoma at that time, where we rehabilitated and trained students. And we sent students to Spartan School of Aeronautics, and I was always writing these letters for my boss to Mr. Charles Conley. And so one time I was at a rehab conference, and there was this gentleman, young gentleman, this is many years ago, came in with my boss came in with this young gentleman. I said, well, who is that? That's my boss. And they said, well, that's Charles Conley. And I was real surprised. I thought he was a lot older man, the position that he had, his title. So he sat at the same banquet table with us, and every once in a while I'd look over him, and I'd notice he was looking at me. This was about 27 years ago. And we were both much younger at that time. And after the banquet, we started visiting, and I kind of liked him. And he was a real gentleman. I knew he had a good job, so there was already one point. So then I thought, well, I'll check him out. And I knew I didn't... I had these three children, and with my personality, there's no way I could ever raise anyone else's children. So I want to be sure that if they wouldn't have any children, that I would have to assume any more responsibility. So I kind of hinted around about his past, and he had been married, but he didn't have any children. That's pretty good. So we got to visit him, and then we started dating, and he really did like my children. In fact, he'd always wanted a family. So they just hit it right off, and so we decided we'd get married. There's one thing that really confused me. He drank a lot. He always had this bottle with him. Wherever we went, he had this bottle. In fact, one time my boss said, Barbara, I believe Charlie has a drinking problem. Well, I've never seen Charlie drunk. Now, he drank all the time, but he was never drunk. Probably, if I look back, I probably didn't know what he was like sober. But I know he was sober through the day when he was working, but every spring when he had this bottle in his glove box or in the trunk of the car, and there's this one drink called peppermint schnapps. I've never heard of peppermint schnapps. See, I am naive. But it smelled kind of like a mouth freshener, and Charlie told me it was a mouth freshener. And his breath did always smell good. So before we got in there, one time I mentioned to him, he'd always get that, he hadn't handled his bottle, he'd take a nip off of that bottle, and let me put it back. I said, how can you drink that stuff straight? Doesn't it burn your throat? And he said, now, Bob, that's one of the things I like about you, is that you don't say anything about my drinking. Well, we'll take care of this after we get married. The love of a good woman, I can fix this, you know. So, when we really got serious, we got engaged, and he said, you know, I've got 40 acres over here on the Oklahoma-Arkansas line, and this job, all this responsibility is getting to me, and it's one of the reasons I got to drink so much. And he said, we'll build us a house over there, and I'll retire over there on that farm. I've got a friend who wants me to work in his lumber yard, and I probably won't have to drink so much. Well, I was beginning to notice this drinking, and I just can't understand anybody with the living station. Until I got an obsession with the alcoholic. I always said Charlie had a compulsion to drink, and I had an obsession to stop him. But, I couldn't get, every time, where we went, the first thing he'd grab would be the bottle or a drink. And it didn't make sense. I couldn't imagine someone having to have something that way. So anyway, anything, to stop this drinking. So we did get married, and we started communicating. We talked to Maysville, building this home. Now, most people measure their home by board feet. I would measure this one by six-pack. He would go to the Arkansas line to get his lumber, send his Missouri line to get his case of beer, and his drink and hammer. And it took us about a year to build that home. And in the meantime, I did get pregnant. So there I am, expecting this child, and Charlie, I'm noticing, is drinking more and more. And we finally get moved into this home, and now everything's going to be wonderful. We're going to have this baby, and he'll be so happy. And everything's going to be A-okay. Well, we get moved down there, and Charlie goes out to feed the hogs. He doesn't come back for 2 days. That's very frustrating. I would get so angry, and that's where I started really getting sick. I could see how powerless I was over this person. That no matter what I did, all the things we keep. Everything. I just knew if I just do this right, then he wouldn't do this. And whatever I did this time, it caused him to stay down and not come back. I'll not do that again. And I was always trying to do something different so that he wouldn't drink so much. Start making homebrew. And if I would just make homebrew, he wouldn't leave to go get it, and then he wouldn't disappear on me. And so all the other farm ladies around me were making, you know, canning their green beans and tomatoes, and I'm just having homebrew. The last batch I made exploded. I bought it a little green, and I told Triumph that these bottles were just exploding all over the kitchen. One went off, and it just started all over. And I told him, I said, now see what that's doing in your stomach. But I could see that that wasn't going to work either. So, yeah, there I am now with four children, and her husband is disappearing, and I'm getting crazy and crazy. I've heard the Alateens talk, and, you know, they always talk about the non-drinker in the family. You know, they understood Daddy. You know, Charlie could come in and say hi and pass out, and they understood what was wrong with Daddy. But why all of a sudden did Mother start slamming the cabinet doors and screaming and yelling and cussing and throwing these crazy fits? And that's exactly what I did. I took a lot of my frustration and anger out on the children. I used to watch them with my binoculars. Well, you have to watch an alcoholic all the time. They can just get away from me like that. Well, even drunk, they can get away from me. So, if they were going to feed the hogs, that was a getting away place, because you'd have to get in the truck and go down across the creek. But if I get the binoculars, I could watch it. We had this red pickup, and I could watch it. We had bottles hit around the trunks of these different trees and things. And I'd send the kids down to dump these bottles. You know, anything to aggravate him. He was aggravating me, him. Get even. Don't get mad, get even. And so I'd get played that down a while. But I'd watch it with these binoculars, and you stand and you watch for hours. And the kids are wanting this, or why that, and you know, leave me alone, can't you see I'm busy? You know, you might miss something, you might get away from me. And he always got away from me. I would always keep a track of the mileage to see how far he'd gone, to see who he's with. Now, when you're married to a sex maniac, you know what he's doing. Poor little thing, if I'd had him doing all, he'd had to been a super stud. I'd keep track of the mileage. I would just find out who he's doing this with. Yeah. And so I was obsessed with that. You know, I had to find out what he was doing, who he was doing it with, where he was, and I never did find him. We'd been married 24 years, and 3 years with this drinking. I've been out on 21 years. And there's 3 years that I did all this crazy stuff, you know, and I never found that man. I thought long ago, I said, Charlie, would you write it down somewhere and leave it with somebody and tell me where you were? He said, you mean really, that still bothers you, you really want to know? I said, yeah, kind of you. Well, now then, he probably doesn't know where he was either. I know now about your blackout that you fell asleep. He probably didn't even know whether he was having fun or not. Anyway, that's the way our life was. And I was always threatening to leave, and I'd grab the kids to leave. And by that time, we were raising 40,000 chickens, and we started a hog farm, and we had started out with one sow, and we ended up with about 20. And they'd all start pigging at the same time. If any of you farmers, you probably know what I'm talking about. And he had cattle. He had some on our place. And I don't even know how many he had cattle. In fact, I would go with him to check them. And we'd be out there riding around the field. I said, well, how many cows do you have? I said, being a city girl, I just said cows. I thought all four-legged things that were newer cows. And he'd say, well, I've got 50 cows and 70 heifers and 4 bulls. I said, Charlie, I just want to know how many of those things go move. So I'd tell him what's out there. But there's all these animals and things going on all the time, and Charlie's disappearing on me. You know, and I'd say, why do you go up and leave me with all this stuff? And he would come staggering in, you know, after the next morning, finally, you could handle it. Then when he sobers up, he's going to be the boss again. Well, heck, I thought I was supposed to be him. Now it's his turn. And then when he's gone and he's drunk, it's my turn. And we're always getting confused about whose turn it was. You know, damned if you do and damned if you don't. So, anyway, things are just getting crazier and crazier, and I'm doing all these crazy things to get even. You know, Charlie had to get drunk to do some of the crazy things he did. I didn't. You know, I planned them. I was going to get even, by golly, and I'll try this. Some of the things I did, I couldn't even tell him about, but I knew I was even. You know, get ahead of him. You don't know, I even got ahead of him a time or two. But I noticed that one night I sat out on the country road trying to make him wonder where I was. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 minutes going up and down the road, and I sure this thing, no wonder that man drinks, that's his crazy wife. When he looked back, somebody was taking a film of our lives back then, they could have seen who's crazy in the family. And then I'm sure they would say, no wonder he drinks. the man sitting on this road making wonder, and I know some of you've done that because I've heard you say it too. Mm-hmm. You know, when you come in, they don't know you've been gone. You probably thought, thank God, I'm eating the peace, you know. And so the next morning you come drop a little hint how late it was you got in, and he can care less. You know. But anyway, it was crazy. And like I say, the kids were eating honey, eggs, and had bottles. I was always sending out for bottles. Find a bottle. Well, they'd find one in the chicken house or somewhere and come around and ask what to do with it. And I'd say, jump it. You know, it was always asked against them. I was always raining down, telling how, it's his fault I'm this way. You can't bring your kids home from school because they'll see your daddy drunk. The reason I didn't want the kids there, because if he came in drunk, I was going to give him heck, and I didn't want these kids to hear it. So there was a lot of things I blamed on the alcoholic. You know, it was really my fault, but I could use the alcoholic as an excuse. So I really had a lot of compassion and empathy for the Alexians and the children of alcoholics. Well, finally, toward the end of this mess, I decided I'd had enough. And I didn't know what I was going to do with 4 kids. I tried to apply for a job, and there wasn't anything around here but a couple of poultry processing plants. And like I say, we do live in a rural area. Maysville has population 34. Somebody said 34,000. I said, no, 34. The county seat, J. Oklahoma, and that's where I'm working today, has population about 1,200. Southwest City, 600. So there isn't much around there, but there were these two poultry processing plants. I thought, maybe I can get a job in the office there. So I applied, and I thought, if I'm getting a job, I'm leaving him. I'm taking these children, and I'm going to get out. Several times I thought about going back to my first marriage, because he'd have taken me back just for his children, probably. I never had a husband beg me to stay, but they always wanted their kids, you know, and they'd take me back just for the kids. And I took my inventory, I could see that. You know, I never had a husband beg me to stay. And I thought, well, maybe there was something a little wrong with my personality. But I went to this chicken plant to get a job, and then not to hear me tell it. But anyway, I went to this chicken plant to get a job in the office, and they said, we don't have an opening in the office, would you like to go to work on the line? And I thought, well, I'll do anything, you know, anything to get me away from this drum. And so the only opening, I didn't know that they just hired you on the spot. They wanted to know if I could go to work the next morning. They didn't know if I could go to work right then. Well, you work at a chicken plant, you're breathing, they put you on the line. So I told him I'd be back the next morning. So it starts at 6 a.m. 6 a.m. My God, I got to get these babies up. I had two babies. My son, when Charlie got married, I had a daughter 12, a daughter 10, a son that was 2. You'd have to be drunk to marry a woman with those kids, redhead and crazy. But, and then he and I had this baby. So I had to find me a babysitter and make all these arrangements. And Charlie always told me he didn't want me to work. Not me, I'll show him. So I took this job, and I got up there the next morning at 6 a.m., and they put me on the line stuffing giblets and chicken. I never did know much about chickens. I left my grandma with them on the farm, and I brought them in the grocery store, but I never did know how they took all of that stuff apart and put it back in there. I never did, you know, you ever buy a small chicken with a great big neck? I never could see how that chicken had such a big neck. Well, I didn't know they disassembled all the parts, and you had to put all these parts back together. So I'm laying thing on this line, and it's just crazy. These gibbets kind of caught me. All I do is take these gibbets and put them in this little bag, and wrap this little bag. And I thought, well, heck, anybody can do that. So I started doing that, and there's about 4 of us on this table, and pretty soon some chickens start coming along on this line. The gibbets going one way, and the chickens going the other. And I said, now then you start poking as you wrap them and poke them. And so here I'm trying to wrap and poke, and I'm dropping half of them on the floor, and the heart is really hard to hang on to. It just squirts right out of there. Like the floor lady came by and got after me for losing all my heart. But anyway, here I am trying to do this. And first, by the time I started poking those chickens, the more I think about the madder I get. And if all Charlie's father wasn't for him, I wouldn't have to be here. And I'd jam that, poke that gibbet in that chicken, and I'd think of that son of a gun, you know. It's all his fault. Later, he finds out I'm working up here. Man, he's really going to be mad, too. Took him 2 weeks to sober up and find out I was working. Thank God, too. I was really depressed. Now, I tell you what, those people aren't, they really aren't in money. That is hard work. And you stand there for hours, sometimes 10 hours a day is the longest they can work them, but some days would be that long. But anyway, he finally found out I was working, and I said, I better just go home. If I have to, I'll draw welfare, but I am not going to try to work on that line again. I just don't think I can do that. So I did come home, and he told me I shouldn't be working, and I had to think of another way to get out of there. And finally, I decided, well, I'm going to file for divorce and just go on welfare. So I did file for divorce. I went up to this lawyer at Jay and told him I had an old good rotten SOB I was married to, and he was drunk all the time, and I wanted a divorce. And that's what we had. So I came home and I told Charlie what I'd done. Well, he just got up beside himself, you know, and told him, promise me you wouldn't drink if I just dropped that divorce. Well, first I went to the bank and took all the money out of the bank and put it in my name. Charlie's always telling me about this. Of course, I knew I'd have to have something for the children I'd live on. He said, you put the money back in the bank and I'll quit drinking and, you know, we'll straighten this out. Well, that's all I wanted to hear. You know, I really didn't want to get rid of Charlie. I just wanted to quit drinking. So he said the magic word. So I was too embarrassed to go look at that lawyer and tell him I'd changed my mind. After all, I really painted a bad picture of Charlie. And the lawyer might think there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I called him on the phone and told him I thought we could work this out and drop the divorce proceedings. Well, I had to pay half to even get it started. So I dropped the divorce proceedings and Charlie stayed sober for a while. About 4 months go by and he gets drunk again. So I thought, well, you know, the work's drunk, I'll try it again. Well, I'm too embarrassed to go back to the same lawyer. Now, he might think there's something wrong with me. So I go to another lawyer and I tell him the same story, how bad he is, and come home and I tell Charlie. Charlie says the magic words, I'll quit drinking. So I called the lawyer again, told him that I thought we were going to work this out, and he stayed sober and filed in. And I thought, you know, this is going to be all right. But I'm sober. Charlie really wasn't that nice, and I'm sure a lot of you remember what they're like when they're dry. You sometimes think, oh my God, I just wish you would drink. But anything was better than the drink. At least he did stay around the house. He didn't disappear on me. So my sister was visiting from Tulsa, and she knew there was a problem at home. And one time she brought me some literature from central office in Tulsa, some AA literature, some Al-Anon literature. Well, I'd never heard of Al-Anon. I'd worked for state mental hospital there in Bonita years ago, Bonita, Oklahoma, and that's where alcoholics used to go back in the 50s for treatment centers. And I'd read about the alcoholics, and I thought they were just crazy people, you know, wet brains. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were. In fact, when John and I used to get in our fights back in the drinking days, I'd say, I didn't know I'd married an alcoholic, and he'd say, I didn't know I'd married a crazy woman. I got down and on and found out we were both right. But I read this Al-Anon literature, and I didn't buy that. It says, leave them alone, get off their back, it's a disease, they can't help it. You know, look at yourself. You know, and I thought, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. If he didn't do this, I wouldn't do that. If he pulls my string, I do my thing. If he didn't pull my string, I wouldn't do it. After all, you should do these things to get even or whatever. And you've got to fix it. Maybe this time this trick will work. So I really couldn't buy that philosophy. But I read the AA literature that they brought it, and she brought me, and I thought, yep, that's Charlie all right. He's an alcoholic. I still couldn't understand the disease. You know, I know that if you tell me, if I kept eating certain foods or whatever, it would kill me, I wouldn't do it. And I tell you that because there's nothing like that would do that to me. Now, if you tell me I couldn't eat chocolate, and I know I must be a chocoholic, I don't know if I could quit eating chocolate or not. You know, because I watch my weight, and there's days, and I think, now, I've been good for two days. I have not eaten, and I've lost a pound. Now that I can go back, and now I just pig out. But so I don't know how I could handle it if I had a physical allergy to something. But at that time, I thought, you know, if I had an allergy, you know, if this is causing me all these problems, I'm going to lose my family. I would not do that to someone I loved. If he really loved me, he wouldn't do that. So this strike my interest. And they gave me a phone number for contact in Silence and Arkansas. So things rocked along, and Charlie started drinking again, and it was getting crazy, and I thought, well, maybe I better try it. In fact, I knew how I was going to fix this time. You know, I'm tired of divorcing, I can't leave him, I can't live with him, can't live with him, I don't want him, I don't want anybody else to have him. So I thought, you know, he's getting pretty bad by then. He just pass out and stay passed out for days. And I thought, you know, anybody that miserable shouldn't even be alive. And it says it's a disease, and he's going to die from it. If he doesn't quit, he's never going to quit. And he's going to quit anything before he didn't want to do, stubborn as he is. So, you know, I obviously help him out of his misery. The next time he comes in and passes out in that pickup, I can just run hose down there and stick to him. I've heard about things like that. People doing that when they commit suicide, and it sounded like it was worse. And I could get by with it. I thought about shooting him one time when he came in and telling him that I thought it was a burglar. And I loaded the gun, and then I chickened out because I thought, well, what if I miss? Or, I don't know, I got a moment of sanity and knew that I shouldn't do that, but I didn't know how to unload the gun. said go out and shoot it up in the sky. But I thought, you know, I knew then I was slipping. You know, I was getting pretty sick. But when I planned this deal on the pickup, I knew, you know, I had been working at a mental hospital. I knew that there comes a time when something snaps and you're liable to do something crazy. And you've got four children here, and who's going to take care of these children? And I had a, you know, at least a moment of sanity there. I knew if there was something wrong with me, that I'm going to have to get help for Barbara, whether Charlie does anything about his problem or not. So I called this lady at Siloam and made an appointment to meet her where she worked. And another lady took me over there to see her, and she said, I understand how you feel. I know the loneliness and the frustration. Nobody's ever said they understood. So I tried to tell my folks, but no good SOB Charlie is. I said, Bobby, he doesn't seem that bad. Well, probably compared to me. He probably wasn't. You know, he did make a living for his family, and he could conduct business drunk. You know, most alcoholics can do just about anything. And they're great con artists, and they're, you know, they've got such good taste. Look what they picked. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they really are. Most of them are really, most of them, you know, really can do just about anything and can convince people, and people keep getting chances and all. And, you know, I've been concerned about Charlie, and they always, well, Bobby doesn't seem that bad. Well, and the public really wanted to, he could really straighten up at his home. So if it was home where I was going to jail. But she said she understood. And I thought, I can't believe it. Somebody finally understands how I feel. So she told me about this meeting on Friday night there in Salem. But she wouldn't be there, and so she gave me another contact, a lady that works in another poultry company, and go by and visit with her. So I went by to visit this lady, and she comes walking out, and she's my sponsor today. Her name is Wanda. And she's just this bubbly, happy little girl lady. And I thought, now, she's never lived with an alcoholic, but she couldn't look like that if she had. So she said, yes, she would meet me and take me to my meeting. She was just so excited to see me. You know how we are to meet new people. You know, that's what keeps us going, is a new contact, because it just makes you so grateful you've got somebody to give. You know, if you don't have someone to give, it just kind of dies, and you just have to keep it moving. And she was just so excited about it. So between, you know, that was on like a Monday or Tuesday. Between that time and Friday, Charlie and I had another one of our discussions, and we got in an argument. And this time, I remember an article, a line in that pamphlet, in the Alma kind of thing, if you make a decision, stick to it. Well, this time I'm going to leave him, and I'm going to stick to it. So I went to the third lawyer, and that was the last one in jail. I went to the third lawyer, filed the divorce, and this time I had him moved out. I thought, I'm sticking to it. So when Wanda called me on Friday morning to see if I still go to meet her in this other town, divide with her to Siloam 30 miles away, she said, I don't need to go to this meeting. And I said, no, I don't need to go. I've gotten rid of my problem. And I filed for divorce, and this time I'm sticking to it. And she just kept going on. I thought, you really should go to Al-Anon. Now, you're telling the scars of living with an alcoholic. You really should go. And I'm thinking, why should I so adamant about getting to a meeting unless it was a membership drive or something? I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I couldn't have known about AA either. That was in 68. So there really wasn't all that much about Al-Anon, and very little about AA on TV or anything. So I didn't know why she was so adamant about getting me there unless it was a membership drive or you get a prize or something for bringing the most people or something, kind of like a Tupperware party or whatever, you know. So I finally consented to go. And I went to that first meeting, and they do that there like they do at my home group, and there's a lot of home groups that you all probably go to. When there's a new member, they kind of go around the table and tell them a little bit what Al-Anon is. And what it isn't. And this one lady described the disease of alcoholism. And I thought, you know, that sounds like Charlie. His drinking has nothing to do whether he loves you or not. He does that because he doesn't have any power to choose once he takes that first drink. And because of his mind, it's mentally addicted to alcohol, and things get rough. You know, he takes a drink, and he can't stop. And they said, now we know why Charlie does what he does. Now, do you know why you do what you do? And that didn't, I thought, you know, wonder why I do what I do. I think most of us want the best things for our spouses, men or women, whichever. You know, we want the best, and what the behaviors that we do we think are the best. So what we wanted wasn't wrong, it's just the way we were going about things. So they struggled in my interest there, and I thought, you know, if it's a disease, maybe I ought to try harder on this marriage. You know, it's the very worst of sickness and health, and if it is a disease, I will try it for at least 6 meetings. That would be 6 weeks. At that time, they wasn't letting me out on meetings around. So I went home, and I called Charlie, and I told him I thought I knew what the problem was, if he wanted to come home. Of course he wanted to come home with his children. Charlie was a fantastic father. Even with these stepchildren, they are real close. Much closer sometimes with him than they were with me because of the way I was acting. So he came home, and I continued to go to meetings. Now, if you're going to meetings and your husband drinks, and they're not very happy about that. You know, they meet you at the door, and they give you a heck about running out and going, what kind of woman are you? And you come back smiling and feeling so good, and they wonder what's going on. Mm-hmm. Finally, we got interested enough to try it, and I've been in about a year. And thank God I had a head start, because I don't know if I'd have been able to. He probably couldn't have lived with me sober had I not gotten rid of a lot of these great resentments that I had. But things were going along pretty good, and we both got active in service, and I knew what to get. Oh, it's probably been so about 6 months. We would come back from a meeting, and I've been working on amends, and Charlie was the last on the list. And so I thought, you know, he's beginning to act about halfway decent. That first year of sobriety, I hated him that first year. And so I heard him talk from the podium when he got his kick the first year birthday. So he talked about during that first year of sobriety, there were times he felt so bad. Because I know, by that time I did get a job. He finally consented to me going to work. And the postal company that I had applied at to work in the office called me to work as a payroll clerk. And that's 20 years ago, and I'm still with the same company. Mm-hmm. And so I'd come home from work, and they'd try to be sitting there sober in that chair. Cigarette butts, and wasn't even a big book. He read all these other silly books that I thought he shouldn't have been reading. And tell the kids to do all the chores, and I think, you know, big deal, sobriety. You know, when are we going to get on with this thing? You know, life and the good stuff that should be coming on. Like I did in meetings and telling them, since they're coming back, it's not working. You know, why should I keep changing when he's saying the same? Now, I want to see some results out here. And he said, Barbara, when you came, we didn't get it. We guaranteed you work the steps in your life will get better. It won't get better in Charlie's life, but your life will get better if you work these steps. But I still wanted to see these results, and I was a little resentful of the way he was acting and caring, you know, wouldn't do anything. And when he spoke at that first birthday and talked about how he sat in that chair, he said, you know, I knew that if I would get up and leave that chair, I would probably have to go get a drink. I felt so bad. Oh, my gosh. You know, the thing, you know, how we judge people. And I thought, I'll never judge anyone again because I really don't know what motivates them to be the way they are. I just have to let them be what they are and accept them that way. And you know, they were always saying the surest way to make a man think and so. Well, you know how they act that first year. I don't know how your husband was, but Charlie, first year, first 10 years, first. But you know, I think part of it is because I was expecting things, and we always had so many means on expectations and acceptance. And I was so hard to take him like he was and know that he was not going to be a different person. You know, he may get better in certain areas, but there's certain characteristics that we'll always have. Charlie was very slow, methodical, consistent. I'm inconsistent, nervous, hyper. You know, we are so opposite. There's so many times that I've had to, that's one time I was saying something, how can you sit there all day? You know, I come home one evening, he's sitting all day. We didn't know what to do with that. He said, did you think there might be something wrong with somebody who's too busy all the time? I thought, no wonder I'm always having trouble with people. 3 years ago, I had cataract surgery. And it reminded me of how I changed in Al-Anon. They said, Bobby, the first thing you're going to notice is color. When I knew colors, I wasn't colorblind, but I knew not colors, but he said, the first thing you'll notice will be color. So when I had the first eye operated on, I got home and had to put the bandage off. I looked at my flowers that were red flowers hanging on the porch, and they were the most vibrant, beautiful red that I'd ever seen. And then I looked through the other eye, it was this old faded color of red. And I thought, well, that's how I had been seeing life before I had Al-Anon. You know, how I saw it is how it was. And if you didn't see it the way I was seeing it, then you weren't seeing it right. And I thought, no wonder I'm always having trouble with people. I always use the illustration of Charlie's coat. And I was going to meet him, and you want me to get your coat? And he said, yeah, my brown coat. Well, he didn't have a brown coat. I buy his clothes if it was clean. Kind of greenish brown, but it was clean.
And I started telling him the coat's green. And then I thought, no. Yeah, that guy didn't see that as brown. He has the right to see that as brown. And if you want to feel good, you better give other people the right to see things this way. So I was gradually trying to change. And that's when, my life started getting better, when I started giving you the freedom to be what you are and see things the way you see things. After I had the other eye operated on, I told Charlie, I said, now I see everything the way they really are. It's like we do in the spiritual awakening. We see things as they really are. What God has made is beautiful. He doesn't make junk. Everything has a purpose. One of the truths I've learned is that whatever man has made, man can fix. But whatever God's made, only God can fix. So, this little things that are so simple finally came to me. So I had this daughter, and of course I'd heard enough at open meetings about the inherited part of alcoholism. And now it's just, it has been proven it is you can inherit that disease. Just like you can inherit, I inherited the cataract from my relatives. And so any physical thing can be handed down. So I thought, well, I've heard these alcoholics talk, and I know what makes them tick. I know that they feel insecure and don't feel like they belong. And so that's how they drink. So this child will never feel that way. I will fix her. So from the age one, we just, of course, being his only child, he just spoiled her rotten. In fact, I couldn't even discipline her. And when she started getting into having some problems, in fact, she told me one time about taking some drinks over to the neighbor's party, and I said, oh, honey, you shouldn't feel that stuff. Now, if you really haven't heard the physical allergy of alcohol, you could start the compulsion at the age of 15, and I just felt like I could stand to watch another person die from alcoholism. Oh, she said, if I ever got as bad as Daddy, I wouldn't drink. I've heard people say that. And she was about 3 when Charlie could drink, so she really didn't know what he was like, except that she was raised in AA, and I don't know, these 2 younger children were just drugged from meeting to meeting, so they don't have lung problems from all the smoke they didn't have. They were raised in AA and Al-Anon. We would go to meetings every night after we got real active. So here's this child that I had fixed, I thought, starting to do some strange things. She was from an A student. She was one of the highest IQ in her class. I think when she was in the 6th grade, she had 11th grade IQ, and just an exceptionally bright child. Started bringing home C's and D's. And things were, I began to see some things that I didn't know about. I was just as naive about the drugs as I was about booze and sex. And so, one time I was going to plant some tomato seeds, and she wanted them to plant in her, to put, grow in her window. And when hers came up, they didn't look like my plants. So I said, now, Charlotte, if that's what I think that is, you better get that out of the house. Well, she took it down in the drawer. And every evening she'd get off that bus, she'd head down to the drawer. I guess she's checking out her crop. But anyway, she'd always, she'd be carving little pipes, and I'd find these funny little things in her drawers. Well, that Phil Burnett article came out about, you check your child's room. Well, I started, oh God, going in a teenager's room. It's horrible anyway. I tried never to open the door on any of my children's rooms until they left home. When the girls went off to college, I finally went into the room and cleaned it out. In fact, when I told him, I said, when you leave, take everything you want, because once you're gone, it's not going to be just, I'm cleaning it out. But, so I went into this room and started going through drawers. I found wigs and pipe, glass things with, I don't know, and notes about mushrooms. But, you shouldn't eat mushrooms, because that kid knew what time, my grandmother wouldn't even hardly let me get a raw mushroom, but I knew what they were talking about, all these things that they were talking about. And of course, girls were so promiscuous, more promiscuous than, it seemed like they weren't afraid of anybody. Well, they didn't have pool hall to write your name on, I guess. But anyway, all these things that these girls were writing back and forth in notes, and I thought, oh my God, well, I quit my job. I told them, I said, I'm going to have to stay home a while. So I quit my job so I could watch Charlotte. So I started watching her just like I did Charlotte. I started putting out, laying traps, tying strings on the door with a can so I could hear when she slipped out. In fact, one night about midnight, we got a call from somebody, and they said, "But did you know your daughter slipped out at night about midnight and comes in at 3 hours in the morning?" And she said, "The only reason I'm telling you is because I've got some daughters of my own I thought you might want to know." So Charlie goes in her bedroom, and I hear him cuss, and I thought, what's going on? He walks in, and then he told me about the phone call, and he said, she's not in her room. So we get in the car. He gets his baseball bat. That's his weapon. He's about So we get the baseball bat and we start driving up and down the same roads I used to drive up and down looking for Charlie. Now about everything goes full circle. It's his turn now, yes. But I know that there's a creek that runs not too far from our place, and a lot of times the kids do have their parties down there. Back if it'd been in our days, it would have been booze parties. Now I guess it's pot parties. But anyway, they'd have the parties down there, unless she probably got down there and couldn't get home or something. So anyway, we couldn't find her. She finally came in about 2 in the morning in bad shape. So things were getting worse and worse and worse, and I could see what I was doing to her. And I was just driving a wedge between us. She just hated me. And she would tell me she hated me. And I'd say, well, I don't blame you. You know, I hate people too that don't let me have my way. I'd had enough of Al-Anon, which after this was about 10 or 15 years in Al-Anon, to know, you know, that she, but then you have a little more compassion for a child than you do for a spouse. Mm-hmm. You know, and I knew what she was going through because of not, you know, I'm sure she had some guilt at times. And I didn't want to give her any more guilt than she probably was already living with. But I finally knew what I was doing, and I was going to have to get back on some kind of friendly terms with her in case she did want some help. You know, I had to leave the doors open. So one morning I took her down to the school bus, and I told her, you know, I said, Charlotte, I need to apologize for the way I've been acting, and I'm going to get off your back, and I'm going to set you free. Maybe it's necessary for you to do some things that may cause you some pain, like it did your father. But as it says in the chapter of the family afterwards, there may be something you're going to have to learn so that you can help somebody else someday. So, honey, I'm never going back in your room. Whatever you think you need to do, you know, I guess you'll just have to do it, and I love you. And she just was so relieved. I could just see her just relieved, you know. And we started being on a pretty good friendly basis at the end. School was out, and I went in one morning. I still hadn't gone back to work. And to call for breakfast, she's gone. I knew something was wrong when I opened the door, the room was clean. And we could tell that she'd taken some clothes and she had disappeared. Well, I don't know. You know, until this happens to you, you always think that's what happens to other people. That didn't happen to me. That's what I thought when Charlie was doing these weird things. That can't be happening to me. You know, that's not what I set out to do in life. You know, if God loved me, he wouldn't be giving me these kind of things. And I love, you know, I try to do what's right. Well, I almost did if Charlie had made me do some of those thou shalt nots. It's his fault. Thank God we had the fourth and fifth step in Al-Anon to take care of that. But, so, you know, we find out, well, we better go to the proper authorities and turn her in as a missing child. And I called what things I thought she would have known. We drove down to the creek to make sure she wasn't lost down there or something. And so they started looking for her. Well, in order for them to hunt a missing child, she had to become a ward of the court. And they did find her a week later. Well, you know, in Al-Anon it says, when a crisis happens, and one of our pages in the ODAC, when a crisis happens, you keep on doing what you'd be doing if this crisis wasn't happening. So I tried to go on about my business and go on the meetings and do what I thought I needed to be doing. But you know how you're in the back of your mind, and I'm getting angrier and angrier. And I've done everything they've asked me to do in Al-Anon. I was always afraid to say no. I don't ever want to go back to like I used to be. And if you told me to run around the house naked 3 times a day, my life would get better. I'd have done it. Because I was afraid not to. I didn't like it, and I'd argue with you, and I'd tell you I want to see some results when I do it. But I'd do it. And so I thought, this is not fair. And I told Charlie, I said, this is not fair. Is this God's reward for me doing everything that I was supposed to be doing, for turning my life and then over to God? Is that, you know, is this my reward? And he said, Bonnie, God doesn't reward. God doesn't punish. You do good, you feel good. You do bad, you feel bad. And so, well, that makes sense. And then one day after about the fourth or fifth day, I was really getting scared. Fear, you know, I was getting so terrified. We always think of the horrible things that be happening. You know, like with your husband when you had a horrible car wreck and all these bad things, and he's just been shacking up having a ball. Yeah. But anyway, I'm thinking, you see, all these horrible things that could be happening to this beautiful 15-year-old blonde. And developed like she was about 18. And it's fine. I'm so angry with God, and I'm down on my knees, and I'm saying, God, you know, why me? And he says, well, it's like his voice says, why not you? Bobby, your life is in order. You go on about your business. There's nothing happening to you. You're doing exactly what you're supposed to be doing. You know, I'm going to my meetings. I'm helping other people if necessary. Whatever it takes, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. He showed it to me. Charlotte has some things she's going to have to learn. You know, and I knew this, you know, and yet it's just like a clear thought just came to me that I have to turn her loose. Leave her to me. She'll be all right.
whatever it is. So I knew that whether she was going to die from an overdose or whatever, you know, if it's time, it's time. And we all know that. You know, no matter what, you know, I just know there's something on down the line that's going to, when it's time, and not until it's time. When you turn your life in the middle of the care of God. So I released her. And since that time, I've really had a close relationship with my husband. I think when you finally get so desperate that you know you've had to release the thing that is the dearest to you, that you know that there really is a God. On a Saturday, Charlie had to go on to a state assembly or something, and he said, "Bart, I'm going to have to go if you think it's all right." And I said, "You know, you got to do what you have to do. You know, we can't just stop everything." So he went on to his meeting, and Little Rock and I got a call. They found her. So she didn't want to come home, so she became a ward of the court for about 3 years, in and out of different institutions and foster homes, and doing some of the craziest things. She was a rebel. And I see so much of her personality, you know, my personality in her. In fact, when they finally did a psychological test and everything on her, Charlie read it and just laughed. And they looked at him like, what's this deal? And I said, "This is typical alcoholic personality." You know, in fact, she was at this one children's home, and we'd go over to see them. And they said, "Well, now, you know," they started, first of all, they said, "Well, you know, you drank." They're trying to find something wrong with her, you know, that we did wrong. That's the first thing. They've got to find somebody to blame. And see, I did too. I blamed Charlie. I kept saying, "You whipped her when she was four. If you'd rather done this or that," you know. And finally, one day, he told me, "I'm tired of you blaming me on this." But, you know, you just want to blame somebody. And not then the mother. You know, you want to blame yourself. If I hadn't gone to so many meetings. In fact, the counselor, the probation officer, tried to lay that on me. And I remember when she was doing these things, and I thought, well, I'll stay. She always wanted to go to the football game on Friday night, and that was my Al-Anon meeting. And I would either send her with somebody else or wouldn't let her go. So I finally decided I'd go with her. So I took her to the game. She disappears with her boyfriends and the pot parties and all, and I sat there through the ball game and missed my meeting. Mad and hit by the time I got home. And I thought, there's no sense in doing that. So when the probation officer laid that on, I said, "Listen, I took that kid to James. But I, you know, when it didn't work, I figured I needed my Al-Anon meeting more than I needed to sit there at a football game wondering where my child was." So anyway, these counselors and all, they finally realized that we had been doing the right thing as far as we could. In fact, they said, "Well, could you bring us some of your tapes?" Because we had been, you know, we had some tapes in some of our talks, and they said, "Maybe we need to hear some of this." In fact, Charlotte had talked to some of them about some of the things she'd heard. One child was they were getting ready to bring in because of alcoholism in the family. And so she wanted to bring some literature back about Al-Anon and AA to this foster father that's in this one cottage that she was in. And she took that to him. They gave it to his parents, and that little boy, his folks got in AA, and Al-Anon didn't have to come to the foster home. And she was just so excited about doing this. Now she knows, and she knew, she'd heard. It's just that she couldn't use it yet. Finally, when she was 17, the court gave her custody, gave us custody again. We lied because she was living at home so we could get custody. And Charlie asked her then, said, "Charlotte, what do you want to do?" She says, "I want to be free." I said, "Charlotte, you've been trying to be free for 3 years and you've been locked up." In fact, I asked her one time when they had this Raider Center, which is like a reform school. I said, "Charlotte, when I'd go to visit, you know, they had these cameras on you and you couldn't even hardly visit." I said, is having your way worth this?" She said, "Yeah." And it didn't bother her. She just, yeah. And so, I think sometimes it's a big front to put on, probably. But anyway, we did get custody, and she wanted to be free. He said, "Okay, Charlotte, we have custody. You go do what you think you need to do. Call me every week, collect, and let me know what you're doing, how you are, so we can tell the courts and they'll assume you're home." So she takes off to Tahoe and lives a year out there with a friend, and turned 18 and called and wanted to come home. Said, "Mother, I think I've done everything I want to do, and I want to come home." The guy she lived with was putting down some rules, and she didn't like rules. So her daddy sends her plane ticket, and we wait there at Tulsa Airport, and she gets off that plane with her guitar hanging on her hiking boots, and she's I never did. I was like, first I was so thrilled to see her, but here's this little rebel coming home. I tell you what, you know, you always claim when they come when they come home, and then they get home, you wonder, you know, what you always. I said, "Just here, if I could see them and take care of them," and they get there, "Oh my God, they won't pay any attention to what I'm saying. I can't fix her." But I had already gone back to work and had released her. But anyway, she did come home, and that was, she's 23 today. She came home, and she got married. first time she got married, they were married about 9 months. And I don't know, but I think the boy, they were both indulging in some drugs at that time. And he committed suicide. She had left him. He'd beat up on her every weekend, especially when Charlie would be out of town. And if anybody knows Charlie, he's gone every weekend. He's booked up through 1992. Every once in a while, he has a heart condition. He's always talking about how bad he feels. And he doesn't know if he's going to make it another day sometimes. I said, Charlie, you know you'll make it till 92, but God's never booked anything yet, but why he didn't follow through. So, you know, we're safe till then. He and Joe have a pretty heavy schedule. But there's this young man committed suicide. Of course, like I say, he'd beat her up every weekend when he'd be gone. And she was doing strange things like go buy groceries and wouldn't come home till the next day. Mm-hmm. And in fact, before they got married, she did that once. And they got this different thing now where you practice getting married. So she was practicing. And so when he told me about this, I said, when I did it, if I were you, I would just start going to Al-Anon with me. And he says, I'm not going to live with somebody that does that. And I said, no, the normal person doesn't. You know, in fact, an alcoholic told me one time, he said, you know, the normal person, when they marry a guy, and about the second week of marriage, she goes off, she gets cigarettes and doesn't come home for 2 days. She says, you know, I don't think I want to live this way. She packs her bags and leaves. If you're like we are, you know, well, it's probably my fault that he did this. Next time I'll do this and that and it won't happen again or something. You know, so that's the way we are. So when I was telling Dennis, I said, you know, if you're, the normal person wouldn't do that, Dennis, but if you want to live with Charlotte, you might want to start going to Al-Anon with me. Well, he was raised in a very violent home, and he knew nothing but violence. His mother and father were both drinkers, and he'd watched his dad beat up on his mother quite a bit, I guess. He figured that's the way he'd straighten them out, and he tried that with Charlotte every weekend. And so she had left to come home and was still there, and he'd called Dagger to come home. We'd come back from a meeting that night, and she was leaving. I said, where are you going, Charlotte? She said, well, Dennis called and said he was going to kill himself. And I called his brother, and they said, oh, he says that all the time. But she said, I thought I better go over there and check on him. I said, no, maybe you better wait for a while and be careful. You know, you shouldn't go over there if he has a gun. So that's it's about an hour gone by, and the phone rang, and I answered it, and it was Dennis. Now, this boy had never been around any affection, and he just loved us. Charlie and I both. He liked to be around us, and not many sons like to be around in-laws, or son-in-laws like to be around their in-laws. And this young man you could just tell he just ate it up. And he was always so remorseful when he put the daylights out of her. Now, I could just, hey, Ben and Alan, oh, poor thing, you know, how you do? I'd ask Charlotte, are you sure you haven't antagonized him? And she did sometimes, because she didn't tell you, I'd like to thump her around a time or two, but she was home. But anyway, you know, and so this boy, he really was, you know, Charlie and I really did have a special place in our heart for this young man. And, but Charlie did talk to him about beating up. You know, he told him, he said, we can't have that. So, when he called me, he said, Barbara, I need some help. I pulled a trigger, and I've got a big hole. So I told Charlie, and they lived about a mile from him, so he goes over there, and he said, Barbara, you better stay here with Charlotte. And, so when I told Charlotte that, we did go on over there, and the boy had taken a big hunting gun and shot. I don't like that. I don't know guns, but he did shoot himself through the chest. I don't know if he was doing it just maybe to scare to get the attention, but it was low enough that it got into the heart, and he died on the way to the hospital. And that was really a trying thing, and it was really hard on Charlotte. She had a lot of guilt. His mother was living in that area. She had a lot of anger toward us, and it was a pretty tragic thing to have to go through. So she finally got a job. She was working for the poultry company, trying to get a job in the office because she is a very sharp gal and has had computer training. So she was working in the office where I was, and she has since then remarried and been married over a year. She just can't believe it. She's been married a year now without all this. You know, she had such a bad deal on her first marriage, she didn't know how this was going to work out. But she seems to be on top of the world, and I say she and I do work together. She's pregnant, and she started wearing maternity clothes. She was so excited about it. First she knew the one children, now she is, but she hasn't had any drugs for a long time, and now she won't even drink coffee with caffeine in it. She's gotten so pure. And she keeps hoping she'll have a boy. Of course, I said, Charlotte, little girls are so precious. You know, I said, Mother, they may be like me. But, you know,
if I had prayed for anything, you know, I would never prayed for anything this good. You know, all the things I've ever wanted in my life, back when I was a young person, all the things I'd prayed for and wanted and my dreams were never as good as what I have today. The relationship that Charlie and I have today, I know that I must have had a type of personality that would be hard to get along with somebody because I always wanted my way. And Charlie always wants his way, too. So we've had a difficult time. Thank God for the traditions and the concepts, you know, that we've been able to keep our marriage together. You know, a lot of times, we've lost a lot of people that just can't make it. You know, it's hard to change. And if one doesn't change, you know, Bill Wilson warned the Al-Anons at the very first Al-Anon conference in New York City that AAs don't quit drinking, they grow away from drinking. And if you don't grow with them, they'll grow away from you. And you know, it can almost go the other way. I know that if I had started going to Al-Anon and I kept changing, I don't know, but I had a feeling probably I would have grown away from Charlie eventually and would maybe have been drawn to someone that we would have more in common or something and would have grown away and maybe would have sought a different kind of partner. I don't know. So I just feel like we are just doubly blessed. In fact, we're always saying that to each other. You know, for nothing else, we are so comfortable with each other today. We're not trying to have all these expectations. And I know, Al-Anon, that's the first thing. In fact, Charlie, the only argument we have about the big book and or the steps, we'll argue about different interpretation of the steps. And I say, Charlie, we work the same steps as AA, but we work them a little different. Now, Bob, there's only one way, the way that the big book says. I said, well, I know that, but there's still something different. And I couldn't come up, because he is a very knowledgeable type of person about, well, especially about the big book and words, and he can always remember things. And I kept trying, what is different? And then I realized, when I started going to Al-Anon and started working the steps, the first place I wanted to use these principles was in my marriage. And I've heard Charlie say it for the podium, and I imagine there's a lot of you, probably feel the same way. The last place that he was able to do it was in the marriage. So it takes a long time for you to finally get to where you're at the same, working at it at the same place. You know, I finally remembered how it felt when he got off my back, when he didn't expect everything to be on his time at all times, you know, when he finally gave me a little freedom to be wrong and to screw up or whatever, you know, or that like he was on my side. You ever come home about a problem and he's always saying, well, that's just the way you are, and it's like he's never on my side. And I told him that one time. I said, Charlie, you're never on my side. Even if I don't like what you're doing, and I think sometimes you may be wrong, you know, if you're disagreeing with somebody else. You know, I always want you to feel like at least I'm backing you up. Whether it's wrong or not, I'm backing you up. But I said, you're never on my side. And he was kind of quiet there for a minute. And finally he patted me on the leg. He said, well, what you need is for me to be your buddy. So now he's my buddy, too. But you know, there's just something miraculous happens if you just keep on working these steps. You know, I thought that when I came to Al-Anon, I was going to learn how to live with an alcoholic, and that's why I'm here. But it was learned, you know, if I hadn't had Al-Anon first, I'd have never been able to cope with the daughter. It helped me in my job. Today, I feel like I really have, you know, had a spiritual awakening, and I'm comfortable with where I am. And it's just wonderful to be here with people that I've never met before, and I feel like I've known you for a long time. And I thank you very much for the weekend.